Okay. So, let us continue where we left off this morning. Now, we're going to have a look at what is called the Bhadekaratta Sutta, One Fortunate Night. It's quite a simple sutta in many ways, but it also has a very, I think, quite an important message about meditation practice. And it's kind of phrased in a nice verse in the Pali, so it's kind of quite nice and inspiring at the same time. And it's quite a basic thing, but of course, as far as meditation is concerned, the content here is quite important. It's the sort of thing that you hear about all the time, and this is where you hear about it in the suttas, about letting go of the past and the future, and then staying in the present moment instead. So this is how it goes. There's actually four suttas of this one in the Majjhima Nikaya, so it's quite a popular sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So, thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "I shall teach you the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night or a single fortunate night. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the monks replied, and the Blessed One said this. So this is elsewhere, is said to belong to kind of what the Buddha calls the fundamentals of the holy life. Yeah, one of the kind of basic things to do with the holy life. It is said somewhere. And here he says, listen and attend closely. That's what he often says when he speaks. So that people are ready to kind of take in the Dhamma. "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly by day and night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has a single excellent night." So that's the Bhadekaratta verse, and it kind of versifies to be easy to remember for the monks. And very simple, kind of basic message about not going into the future, not going into past, but stay in the present moment. It's a simple one. Reviving the past or going back to the past, anugameya means like to go back to or go along with the past. The idea, of course, in Buddhism is that, if you want to see things clearly with insight, you have to stay in the present moment. You don't get any insight by looking into the future, going into the past. This is exactly what mindfulness is all about. So this ability to let go of the future and past is so fundamental to the practice of mindfulness and being able to watch the breath or anything else. And this is why it fits into this particular place on the path. So how do we actually do this? And it's not, many things kind of coming together to make this easy. One of them is to enjoy the present moment, having done all the right things so that the present moment is enjoyable. But also it's useful to remember sometimes how useless it is to go back into the past. One of the problems with going back into the past is that what you see when you remember the past, actually you never see the past anyway. What you see is like how you interpret that past event in the present. And very often we see the past through kind of rose-tinted glasses, and we see what we want to see in the past, or we see it by fault-finding, by judging the past. Yeah, those are often the two possibilities. And both of those are basically slanted views of the past. Yeah, usually when you think about the past, you think a bit about something fun you did in the past, something that was really nice, and you only remember the positive. Yeah, you go through an old album, in the pictures, everyone is smiling. Yeah, this is why people smile in pictures. Actually, it's a stupid idea to smile in pictures, because then you think about the past. Oh, the past was so wonderful. Look, we're not smiling now in quite the same way. We should look really miserable in pictures. That would be much better, much more Buddhist. Look really miserable. You look into the past, look at good riddance of the past. Yeah. And then to go to the present moment instead. Huh? You have a chance tomorrow. Okay, tomorrow we can practice. A good idea. Looks ultra miserable. Yeah, because the last retreat was bad. But this retreat is going to be much better. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that excellent idea. We'll try that out tomorrow. But so that is how it is. And because memory is inherently unreliable, because it is so uncertain, it is pointless to kind of go back into the past. And the reason we go back into the past is just to find something better than the present moment. But it's really a lie. What we see is not true. And also, if we try to after we've done something, we try to kind of review it to see if we've done it. We try to avoid making the same mistake again as we have done in the past, by trying to think about it, and second guess what we did before. And very often when we try to look at the past and try to figure out what went wrong, again, we often get it, I shouldn't have done that, I could have done something else. But actually, very often we couldn't. It's the present. In the present, the past looks different. And actually, again, the way we look at the past is often just a lie, it's not the reality here. So watch yourself when you kind of look back and you fall fine with what you did in the past and you think you could have done better. The question is, could you really have done better here? And very often the answer is no. You can maybe learn from it now, but you cannot actually, at that time, you very often couldn't have done better. And if you realize you couldn't have done better, you don't feel guilty anymore. The guilt comes because you think that you could have done something differently. But very often it's not actually true. So a lot of this going back to the past is just a waste of time. Learn from it. Make sure you kind of avoid doing the same thing again, but don't kind of hang out there. And then there is a possibility of letting go of those things. So see it as kind of a distortion, yeah? And of course, the future is just as bad. Building hopes on the future or having expectations for the future, what this is about. Patikanka means like to expect about the future. It's the same thing, or perhaps even worse. The future we know even less about than the past. It is so incredibly unreliable. And very often you make plans, and whenever you make plans, you have to make sure you have a lot of flexibility, because very often it doesn't work out the way you want things to work out. So thinking about the future often is also a waste of time. Of course, it doesn't mean that we should never plan anything. Sometimes you have to plan a little bit, but it just means that you don't kind of have any expectations. You don't think about it as, oh yeah, in the future it will be like this, it will be like that. In fact, and I think this is kind of the interesting point that, Ajahn Brahm always talks in this particular way. He says that the future is made in the present. If you want to have a happy future, instead of fantasizing about it or thinking about it, you stay in the present moment to make sure that the mind that you are creating now, that you do the right things now, you live well, you think in such a way that actually you do create a future in the present moment. That's how you create a future, by staying in the present. It's interesting. It kind of reverses the psychology. And it's true, because if you want to be able to react appropriately in the present, you really have to stay in the present moment. These are very simple things, very basic, but so important on the Buddhist path to get these very basic things right. And once you get that right, well, then the mind tends to draw into the present moment much more easily as a consequence. So then the Buddha says, for the past has been left behind. Yeah, there's nothing more to be done there. Living in the past is just really, you're not living at all, really. And the future has not yet been reached. It is uncertain, unreliable. Don't know what's going to happen in the future. Instead, with insight, let them see its presently arisen state. This is the Pachupanna Dhamma. And Pachupanna means present. Dhamma means like quality or phenomena. Yeah, it means like, in other words, let one see the present experience. That's really what it means. So see the present experience, and insight, vipassati, means something like having clarity about the present experience. Seeing the present experience clearly is really what it means in this context. It doesn't mean that you have insight kind of continuously or anything like that. It just means that you see the present experience continuously. With clarity. Let them know that, and be sure of it. It actually means something like to develop it or to practice it. Yeah, you develop that present moment awareness. And one of the things that you realize on this path of meditation is that mindfulness has so many different degrees to it. You can be reasonably aware, but you can be very aware. You can be incredibly sharp in the present moment. You go to the Indriya Samyutta, it tells you that mindfulness has all these different degrees depending on how well your mind is developed. Yeah? So it comes in large number of degrees. And sometimes you feel really awake, really present. At other times you're kind of semi-present, it's much more dull. And that depends, of course, on how developed your mind is, how far you are going to, to what extent you are aware. So you should develop these things to make it more powerful. And that's when you see that, you start to realize that the more powerful that mindfulness is, the more ability you will have to see things properly in accordance with reality. So our job is to develop a very powerful mindfulness. So often it is kind of assumed that mindfulness, you've got to be mindful, and mindfulness is just mindfulness. But actually that's not really the case. Mindfulness comes in a vast number of different degrees. And so just the starting point when we start out with the meditation practice. So you know that invincibly and unshakably. This means that invincibly here is mean like you are like immobile, you're not really movable. Unshakable, it means that you are not perturbed, you are not really, the phenomena that you observe don't really shake you, they don't make you fearful or anxious, but you are kind of solid, you're standing your ground, so to speak, and being able to observe whatever arises in your mind. And then here we are moving to, you can see how even in these simple verses, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. To be able to do things invincibly and being immobile and unshakable in this way here. The only way you can do that is, again, by having, some either very strong samadhi experience or you already have some insight. And the main insight here is to be aware that these phenomena are not you. They are not self. Because as long as you take these phenomena to belong to you and you observe them, whenever you have insight into something, you see it as non-self, but you think it is self. Or you think it is permanent and you see it as impermanent, that's when you start to shake a little bit. You become a bit fearful because you're seeing something which challenges your very existence, your very sense of who you are. So to be completely immobile and unshakable here is actually quite, already now we're moving to more profound states of insight and samadhi. So this is already getting more difficult, but it's much more profound already here. And then we have this second last verse here, which also is very nice, and it kind of brings back the idea of the death meditation, we did before, of dying. And today the effort must be made. Now is the opportunity. You don't really know when the opportunity comes back. Death may come tomorrow, who knows? There can be no bargain with mortality. To keep him and his hordes away. You can't really say to mortality, give me a bit more time, please. It doesn't work that way. You've got to, now is the opportunity. So here again, this idea that the contemplation of death, it makes your priorities clear. It makes you very clear what is important, what needs to be done now. And also, it tends to draw the mind into the present moment because everything in this world becomes slightly irrelevant in the face of death. So again, these things going together, mindfulness, death contemplation, all of this is kind of they kind of revolve around each other and reinforce each other. So then one who dwells thus ardently, this ardently again, in other words, energetically, relentlessly by day and night, in other words, without getting tired, without kind of being dull or whatever, keeping on by day and by night. It is he, the peaceful sage, has said, the peaceful sage, the Santo Muni, the peaceful sage. And we have a Santo Muni at Bodhidharma Monastery. You know Santo Muni at Bodhidharma Monastery? Amandus? He has taken the name Santo Muni. So we get this mail all the time saying to Santo Muni, the peaceful sage. That's Amandus, the peaceful sage. This not here is not Amandus, here it is the Buddha, But at the monastery, So, he is the one who has had a single excellent night, who is able to dwell in this way. Anyway, that's just a simple little sutta, not that much to it, on the idea of being in seeing things in the present moment. And then we have the exposition of this, how it is to be understood, And this is how the Buddha explains this particular sutta. How does one revive the past? One nurtures delight, one takes delight there, thinking, I had such material form in the past. One takes delight there, thinking, I had such feelings in the past. One takes delight there, I had such perception in the past. One takes delight there, I had such will in the past, yeah, or intentions in the past. One takes delight there, I had such consciousness or awareness in the past. That is how you live in the past, or revive the past, or go back to the past, if you like. Yeah. So what does this actually mean? Because it's kind of, I had such material form. People don't usually think like that. I had such material form in the past. So what this actually means, it just means this: these were my experiences in the past. When you think about the past, we normally think about experiences. We think about events. We think about things. And again, this kind of draws back, this draws, brings home this idea that the five khandhas, they are really just a particular way of talking about experience. So when you think about the past and you revive the past, you're really just talking about experiences. And those experiences then can be kind of analyzed, if you like, into these various components. Why are you interested in that particular experience? Well, it will somehow relate to these five khandhas in a particular way here. And that's why it is analyzed in this way here. But that's really all it means. And how does one not go back to the past? One does not take delight there thinking, I had such material form in the past, such feelings, such perceptions, such will in the past, such consciousness in the past. That is how one does not revive in the past. Yeah, pretty straightforward. How does one build up a hope or expectation upon the future? One takes delight in thinking, may I have such material form in the future? One takes delight in, may I have such feeling in the future? May I have such perception in the future? May I have such will in the future? May I have such consciousness in the future? That is how one builds up hope for the future. So again, this is about the five khandhas. Yeah, experience. You're hoping to have certain experiences in the future. You're dreaming about the future, like we talked about yesterday. The idea of sensual pleasure as a dream. This is where I want to go. This is where I want to be in a decade's time. I'm going to get this education and everything will kind of turn out in a certain way. I will get this kind of partner in life and then I will live happily ever after. Yeah, that's kind of the fairy tale. That's why they're called fairy tales, because they're not true. The fairy tales. So this is how you kind of think about the future. So what about the Buddhist path? Sometimes we also have this, you know, ideas about where we are heading. Yeah, we're heading towards samadhi, or heading towards nibbana, or towards insight, or whatever. And sometimes that too can become an obstacle. Yeah, and so one of the things, the tricks of meditation practice that we learn after a while is to, yes, those goals are kind of there at the back of our minds. We know that that is where we're heading. But it's not something that you focus actively on during the meditation practice. You leave it aside. You know that these things will eventually arise if you keep on practicing, but it's not something that you actually think about. You, especially during meditation, you lay it to one side. You're not worried about it. And again, it comes back to this thing that to develop the future, to develop these states, it is the present moment in which you actually do that. So you have to be careful. And this is one of the kind of classic problems in meditation practice, is that you have some nice meditation and then you can't get back there and you're kind of struggling. People always talk about this, you know, I had this astonishing meditation. It only happens once, and then the rest of my life I've been trying to get back there, and I can't get back there. What should I do? And this is precisely the problem, is that we get trapped by this expectations about the future, how to get there. So one of the important things of meditation is to learn to enjoy whatever you have. Yeah, these things never come on demand anyway. They never happen when you want them. So the ability to enjoy just what you have now, fully, absolutely, completely, means that you don't kind of desire or expect the future in this way. And this is such an important thing, especially once you had some beautiful experience in meditation. It's important to be able to do that. Let go of that. Yeah, it's gone. It's finished. Yes, it was a great experience. Allow it to kind of to inspire you a little bit, but let it go at the same time. It's difficult, but it's important to be able to do that. Okay. How does one not build upon hope upon the future? One does not nurture delight there, thinking, may I have such material form in the future? May I have such feelings, perceptions, will, and may I have such consciousness in the future? That is how one does not build up hope for the future. And how is one vanquished in regard to the present experiences? Here, the untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones, who is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men, for superior people, and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, they regard material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form. Yes, so this is what I was saying before, that if you are going to be really invincible and unshakable, if you're not going to be vanquished, you have to see the non-self nature in this phenomena. Because when you see that, it can never really scare you again, regardless of what happens. Because you know that these things are just phenomena. You're not going to feel as if yourself is challenged when you see them as impermanent, etc. So these four ways here, I think I mentioned this very briefly before. These are the four ways in which people tend to see a self. Yeah, how we see the self. You have the idea of material form as self. You, in other words, you take the form to be the self itself, or the self as possessed of material form. This is very, very similar, but here there's the self can be broader, but it can include material form. Material form as in self, the material form is a subsidiary factor of self, or the self as somehow residing within material form. So these are just different kind of almost like philosophical attitudes you can have to material form. And then you have exactly the same for feeling, perception, will, and consciousness afterwards. So you know these things, and then because of that you are able to deal with it. Yeah, and this is what the last paragraph is about. And how is one invincible in regard to present phenomena? Here, the well-taught noble disciple who has a regard for the noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, who has regard for the superior people and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, does not regard things in this way. The self as relating to material form, to feeling, to perception, to the will, or to consciousness. That is how one is invincible in regard to presently arisen phenomena. So the main point of that is not really the last two paragraphs. The last two paragraphs are already going into quite deep matters. They're not really the point of the sutta. The point of the sutta is the idea of letting go of the future and the past. Yeah, there is a nice simile that Ajahn Brahm uses of thinking of the future and past as these heavy bags, heavy suitcases that you're carrying around with you all the time. Yeah, all these things that kind of populating your mind and kind of burdening you down. And it's quite nice to think of them as heavy suitcases. They are problematic. They don't really give rise to any happiness. Let go of the suitcases and the mind becomes brighter and lighter and far better as a consequence. So, Bad Ekarvata Sutta, one auspicious night, one auspicious, one fortunate day is that little sutta, is what that is all about. So, let us have a quick look at the next sutta as well. The next sutta is again about Satipatthana practice. That's what we're kind of homing in on now, the idea of how to do the meditation, and specifically the linkage. One of the important things here is to understand the linkage from right effort, leading to right meditation, Satipatthana, and then that leading to right stillness. Because there's a very close connection between all of these factors, and one leading to the next one, leading to the final one. Yeah, and how all of this kind of ties in together. So, this sutta goes as follows. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then a certain monk approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable sir, it would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief. So having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, heedful, energetic, and resolute. And this is a standard thing that you see many places in the suttas. The monks come to the Buddha and say, please give me a special teaching just for me, so I can kind of go off into the forest, withdrawn, alone, and then be diligent, and then get some serious results. And what does the Buddha reply? He replies this: it is just such a way that some foolish persons here make requests of me. But when the Dhamma has been spoken to them, they think only of following me around. It's quite a nice reply, isn't it? And he's obviously trying to tell this monk something. And this monk obviously has got some wrong ideas. This is a nice thing about the Buddha. He's not really trying to get disciples, people following him around. He's trying to kind of get rid of disciples, yeah? And that's quite nice. And this is what any kind of good teacher would say: my job in life is to get rid of disciples. So you teach them until kind of they're self-sufficient, and then they kind of go off and they practice on their own, and they do the right thing, and they become arahants, and they become teachers in the world. This is kind of the purpose of ultimate purpose of the teacher, is to get rid of disciples. And this is what the Buddha is doing as well here. And of course, it's very common that people kind of attach to a teacher. You're attached to the Buddha, you're following him around, you kind of cling on to him, you look at the Buddha and say, wow, you know, I'm so lucky to be his disciple. But really, that luck only comes out in your practice, especially when you go off on your own and you practice in the right way. That is where you see the real Buddha. Buddha says elsewhere, he says that there was one monk who says, oh, I just want, you know, please come and see me, I'm dying or whatever. And the Buddha comes to him and says, I just wanted to see the Buddha one final time. And the Buddha says, well, what is the point of seeing this body? Yeah, you don't see me by seeing this body, the physical body. You see me by seeing the Dhamma. That's when you see me. That's when you understand what the Buddha is all about. But understanding these teachings with insight, not by seeing a physical body. And that is kind of just getting down to business, really. So then this monk is getting a little bit desperate, yeah? So he said, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma in brief. Let the Fortunate One teach me the Dhamma in brief. Perhaps I may understand the meaning of the Blessed One's statement. Perhaps I may become an heir to the Blessed One's statement. So the Buddha kind of sets up the kind of desire. He realizes there is a small problem there. He gets that out of the way, and now he can teach him the Dhamma. Well then, monk, purify the very starting point in wholesome qualities. And what is the starting point in wholesome qualities? Virtue that is well purified and view that is straight. Yeah, then when your virtue is well purified and your view is straight, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, you should develop the four applications or focuses or establishments of mindfulness in a threefold way. And this is one of those statements that I was talking about before, where the Buddha points out what the basis for meditation practice is. And here he's very clear that virtue, yeah, sila, is the foundation of meditation practice. Based upon that sila, established upon it, that is how meditation actually works. So if your meditation is blocked, if it doesn't go any further, you know where to look. Yeah, that is where you look. That is where the problem lies. It is always about virtue. If you look back on the Noble Eightfold Path we have been looking at now, you have all the factor of speech, right action, right livelihood, right action, and all of that is about purifying yourself. That's what it's all about. So if you want to know why your meditation is stagnating, that is where the answer is. We need more purity. We need less. And remember that this is all, it's not just about avoiding the bad things, it's about developing good qualities, yeah? It's about the mental world we have. What is your mental world like? Is it purified or not? So it's a very, very broad idea of morality. It's about character. It's about who we are as people. So all of that has to be brought in. So you have to be you have to be brutally honest with yourself, yeah? What are my weaknesses? Yeah, where can I actually improve? also encourage yourself, of course, you know, look at your progress you have made and say, wow, I've gone a long way on this path. At least I understand a lot of Dhamma, whatever it is. Encourage yourself as well, because otherwise you kind of get down if you always look at what is missing. But sometimes we also have to be honest, brutally honest, and see where are we going wrong? What is actually happening here? Yeah, and of course, coming to a retreat like this, one of the great things on a retreat like this is to get to know ourselves better. Where are our weaknesses? What is our mind like? Sometimes, as I was saying before, just do the walking. Go for a walk in a forest, do a walking meditation, and just observe yourself. Observe the mind. Where does the mind hang out? What is the mind holding on to? Yeah, and you will see little things in there, or sometimes even big things, yeah, that need to be kind of sorted out, to go past that, and then you start to make progress again. This is kind of the thing about uncovering the problems of the mind, uncovering what is actually holding us back. And this is a very important part of the practice. And when we come to the Satipatthana in a second, now we're just talking about the foundation for Satipatthana. Satipatthana is a continuation of that. It's a continuation of uncovering the problems that block us. And that is what Vipassana is at this particular point. Yeah, we are heading for Samadhi. So the Vipassana at this particular point is the Vipassana that uncovers the blockages to Samadhi practice. And that Vipassana is developed in conjunction with Samatha. As I've been saying all the time, Samatha and Vipassana going together, you become calm and you see clearly. You calm yourself down, you watch the meditation as you do so, and that watching of the meditation, watching of your mind becoming peaceful, that becomes the raw data for Vipassana. Afterwards, you understand what is going on because you have seen what is happening here. So you have this twofold awareness, the awareness of karma and also the awareness of the process and how it works. So the sila is really the issue here, which makes or breaks the meditation, but also the straight view. Yeah, the view that is straight. This is the ujjukaditti. And there's many ways in which the view is so important here. And this is one of the things I mentioned before, because the view is often your attitude, your outlook is what gives rise to your priorities in your life, what is important to you, and also in your meditation practice. How do you prioritize your meditation over thinking about the past and the future, yeah, or fantasizing, whatever it is? And the view is what helps you to do that. So ujjukaditti is also, again, a very important part of this path of practice, and it really encourages you. This is what gives you your values. What is really valuable in the world? And your values are then what makes you prioritize certain things over others. So that is the first thing to do. Yeah, so the very starting point has been done. And then when that starting point has been kind of very well established and you are ready, then you can start doing the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four applications of mindfulness, which I like as a translation. And you should do it according to this in a threefold way here. So what are the four? And this four is very similar to what we saw before. Here, a monk dwell contemplating the body in the body, yeah, or an aspect of the body, internally, energetic, fully aware, mindful, having removed desire and aversion in regard to the world. Dwell contemplating an aspect of the body externally, ardently or energetically, fully aware, mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. Dwell contemplating the body, an aspect of the body both internally and externally. Energetic, fully aware, mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. Yeah, so this is what we were just discussing before. And so you know basically what is going on here. And there, as I mentioned, there is a number of ways, number of aspects of the body that can be contemplated here. But I always think the main aspect of the body to be contemplated is the breath itself. Because that is how the Buddha specifically says that you fulfill the four satipatthanas just simply through breath meditation. And that is really all you have to do. So what does it mean, contemplating it eternally? Internally just means it's in regard to yourself. Ajata literally means in regard to yourself. Yeah, and then you have all of these factors here that decide how you do this, with energy, with full awareness. You already have mindfulness, and you already have removed the desire and aversion in regard to the five senses. That is basically what the world means in this particular context. And that is the most important one. That first one is the one that really you need to focus on, because that is the one that will take you all the way to samadhi. When you watch your own breath, that's all you have to do. There's a nice sutta in the Digha Nikaya, Janasabhava Sutta, something like that. Whatever. Too hard to say. So I think it's number 19, 18 or 19 in the Digha Nikaya. And this sutta, it discusses this particular point, and it says that when you follow the breath internally like this, what happens? You get to samma samadhi. Yeah, this is, it specifically says this takes you to samma samadhi when you do the four satipatthanas internally. That is actually where it takes you. Yeah, so this is then, you can see here, the bridge between satipatthana and samma samadhi as the last factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. That is all you have to do internally. Then it also has the same thing externally. Yeah, and this can mean, it is not so important, I think, for our purposes, but it can mean, for example, if you are contemplating the earth element, you contemplate the four elements in the body, you contemplate them first in regard to yourself, then in regard to others. Yeah, other people are exactly the same. Whatever rebirth you have, it will be the same. You can't really escape those elements in the end. And then lastly, you contemplate it both internally and externally, and that is when you kind of make this jump in understanding, and to understand that this is a universal characteristic of bodies. Yeah, bodies always have the four elements. Four elements is everywhere. It's not something you can avoid. That is internally and externally, universal characteristics. And when you see something as universal, that is where you have the really deep insights. This is what impermanence is about. It's not just seeing the impermanence of one particular life or one particular body, but it's understanding this is a universal principle that applies everywhere. There is no escape from impermanence. There is no escape from the four elements. Yeah, these are principles that are ever-present, always valid. And this is kind of what the insight ultimately is about. How do you get there? Well, you get there simply by, usually just by contemplating your own, yourself, your own body, your own breath, or whatever, and eventually that insight arises. And then we have the same thing for feelings. Yeah, you do it internally, externally, internally and externally. The same thing for the mind states or mind qualities. You do it internally, externally, and both. And finally, you do it in regard to phenomena, it says here. Internally, externally, internally, and externally. Ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed desire and aversion in regard to the five senses. So all the way through, it is the same thing. And of course, what is kind of interesting here, and what is important in this, is how is this actually done? Because when if you read this, all the Satipatthana instructions, and there's quite a bit of Satipatthana instructions in the Satipatthana Sanyutta, you find the same thing also in the Satipatthana Sutta, but it doesn't really say exactly how you contemplate feeling. It says, yes, you contemplate various kinds of feeling, but it doesn't really give you a context for how to do these things. And this is where the Anapanasati Sutta comes in, that we're going to look at in a second. The Anapanasati Sutta says that you can complete and fulfill all of these Satipatthanas, all of these things we've been looking at just now, which look a little bit kind of, you know, how do you do this? It looks a bit uncertain. But all of that can be fulfilled through one single practice. And that single practice is watching the breath. That is all you ever have to do. And in fact, if you look through the suttas and you try to see how Satipatthana is to be practiced, there's really only one way that the Buddha describes this as a complete practice. And that is always mindfulness of breathing. Otherwise, he may talk about, you know, the 31 parts of the body or whatever. But as a complete practice, that takes you all the way to awakening. That does everything. The only thing he ever says that about is the mindfulness of breathing. So for that reason, I always favor the mindfulness of breathing as a satipatthana practice, because that is basically what, as far as I can see, what the Buddha teaches. So there you are. And I don't think we need to say too much more about that, because it's just, I'm just kind of bringing it up because it's part of the standard practices in Buddhism. Satipatthana, of course, is important. It's part of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's fairly, it's good to get the kind of clarity about how this is done and what it actually means. So then the Buddha says, when based upon virtue, established upon virtue, you develop these four applications of mindfulness in these three ways, then whether night or day comes, you may expect only growth in wholesome qualities, not decline. I should say maybe very briefly here as well that one of the last of the satipatthanas, the contemplation of phenomena, yeah, the very last one, it is here called, yeah, contemplating phenomena. In many ways, that's also very interesting, the way that actually is described in the Satipatthana Sutta specifically. Because there, the two main contemplations of phenomena is a contemplation of the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. Yeah, those are the two main contemplations in there. Why do I say that they are main? I say that they are main because these are the ones that kind of you see everywhere. When you look at parallel suttas in the other traditions, these are is the mainstay of what contemplation of phenomena, contemplation of Dhamma is all about. And how is it described? It's very interesting how it is described in there. It is described in the Satipatthana Sutta that you, when you look at the five hindrances, yeah, you understand, first of all, what they are. You may think that's simple. Yeah, I know what the hindrances are, but actually it is not that simple because these hindrances go very deep. Sensual desire is a very deep and profound hindrance. So is ill will. And the point is here to be able to uncover these hindrances in the whole breadth, the whole scope. So you understand them when they are very refined, but also when they are very kind of coarse. The whole thing you understand. And you have to understand it fully to be able to let go of it, of course. Otherwise, you can't actually let go of it. So you understand what it is, yeah? And this is the sort of thing you do during your meditation practice. You gather all the data, you're watching the breath, you can see how your mind is getting more and more purified because it's becoming more peaceful, more clear. Yeah? You don't actually contemplate it while you're watching the breath, but you're gathering the data, you see it as you are. You see it just happening in front of your very eyes. And then when your breath, when you come out of your meditation afterwards, to the end of it, you reflect back. And then you see this process happening. And you understand how these hindrances actually become eliminated just by watching the breath. And usually it's an automatic process. Why is it automatic? Because you are withdrawing the interest from those things, and all you are seeing is the breath. And these things can only be sustained if you keep on thinking about them, like desire can only be sustained if you think about the object of your desire. If you stay with the breath long enough, the desire tends to fall away because it's not being fed anymore. The object of the desire doesn't have a chance to arise. So it's almost automatic. And then when you come out of it afterwards, you reflect back and you see the process. But you are slightly pre-programmed to actually be aware of those things, yeah? So that you know that, you kind of know what you have to look for as the process is happening. Yeah? And then you also know the fuel, the things which drives the hindrance, yeah? And then you know how the abandonment of the fuel leads to the abandonment of the hindrance itself. And then you know how there is the non-arising of that hindrance in the future. And this you do for all the five hindrances. You see the links, you see the causality. It is all about Dhammanupassana, is all about understanding causality. It's about, sometimes translated as principles. Yeah, Dhamma in this context, translated as principles, because the principles of the Dhamma are basically principles of causality. Everything in Buddhism happens because of cause and conditions. Nothing happens without that. And this is what you are seeing here. So this is why the Satipatthana is about the final purifying of the mind. Yeah, you understand all of these problems that are there, the final purification of the mind, and that is how this takes you to samadhi. Yeah? So the, in a sense, you are completing the path of purification through the Satipatthana practice. Yeah, all the way going up. And then you have the same thing also for the seven factors of awakening themselves. So this, now you have the positive qualities, if you like. This is like the reverse or the inverse of the five hindrances. So this is the Sati Sambojanga, yeah, the Dhammavicaya Sambojanga, seven factors of awakening, the Piti Sambojanga, all of these. And you see you understand these in exactly the same way. Why does the Piti arise? And you understand the Piti arises because you are becoming very peaceful, yeah, and you have attended to the breath in a way with the right kind of attitude. Then the Piti arises because of that. And the same thing with all the other seven Sambojangas. You understand the causality. A large part of Satipatthana is precisely about understanding this kind of causality and then purifying your mind all the way to the end as a consequence. And this is why the Buddha says it. This is one reason why the Buddha says it, that as you develop these things, you may expect growth in wholesome states or qualities, not decline, because you are actually investigating your mind with that very purpose. And then comes the conclusion of the sutta. Yeah, there's a nice conclusion here. Then that monk, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's statement, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, he departed, keeping him on his right, or rather circumambulating him with his right side towards him. Then, dwelling alone, withdrawn, heedful, energetic, and resolute, that monk, by realizing it for himself with direct insight, in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen, people, in other words, people of good families, rightly go forth from the household life into houselessness. And he directly knew, birth has come to an end, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to a state of existence. And that monk became one of the arahants. So there you are. That's how you become an arahant. It's good to know, isn't it? Now, no more excuses. Now it's just kind of have to kind of do the same kind of thing here. So it's great, isn't it? A kind of a what seems like a fairly simple teaching, I suppose. And then you end up becoming an arahant at the very end of it. So that is a little bit about Satipatthana for you. And now I am going to move on. I will start now, I think, on the Anapanasati Sutta, and this is the sutta on the mindfulness of breathing. And just to, again, the purpose of looking at the sutta is that this is the main way that the Buddha explains Satipatthana practice in the suttas. And one of the questions that we should always ask about the suttas is to ask, how important are they? Yeah, is the Anapanasati Sutta, is it important? Is it marginal? Is it, how significant is it? And the way to find an answer to that is always to remember how often is a particular sutta mentioned overall in the suttas. How often is it taught in different contexts? Does it exist in the agamas? Does it exist in other traditions? And of course, both Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta are things that you find throughout, often again and again explained in the suttas. So, in fact, in one way, the Anapanasati Sutta is found many more times than the Satipatthana Sutta, for example, which, of course, is interesting in its own right. Satipatthana is found in different ways, in brief, but in full, it's only found twice, and one of those is really a duplication of the other one. So, Anapanasati is fundamental, and it is the kind of practice that the Buddha himself supposedly used to attain awakening. Yeah, so this is then what the Buddha has to say in this Anapanasati Sutta. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. when the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. Yeah, so it takes you all the way to the end of the path, the humble breath. All you have to do is watch your breathing, and it takes you all the way to the very end. And through in that process, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness, the seven factors of awakening, and everything is fulfilled as part of that process. So that obviously is a very important statement and something really worthwhile remembering. It simplifies the path in so many ways. You don't have to worry too much or think too much about how the Vedana Nupassana contemplation of feeling is done, for example, because all you have to do is watch the breath and everything is fulfilled as a consequence of that. That's all you really have to do. So when the Buddha says great fruit and great benefit, jeepers, it really means great fruit and great benefit. So you can also see here then how this ties together so many aspects of the path. As we shall see in a second, the basis of doing anapanasati is virtue. Because it is similar to satipatthana, so the basis is the virtue. Then you practice, when you practice it, you are fulfilling the satipatthana, so you do the satipatthana practice, and then it leads on to samadhi, which is the seven factors of awakening. Yes, you can see the path here coming through. You base yourself on the virtue. Then you do the mindfulness of breathing, taking you all the way to samasamadhi, and then that leading on to the final deliverance, liberation, at the very end of the path. It goes, the whole thing kind of goes through like that, purifying yourself, until the mind is absolutely pure and bright, and that is where the insight becomes possible. So how is this done? So this is what the Buddha says next. And how is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, you sit down. Having folded his legs crosswise, he sets his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Then ever mindful you breathe in, ever mindful you breathe out. So that is the basis for the practice. Yeah, and in many ways, as I like to say, in many ways, this is the most important part of the instruction for mindfulness of breathing. Because very often, because everything in Buddhism is causal, if you get the foundation right, everything else tends to fall into place. Yeah, once you get the foundation right, then the rest of the practice is pretty much automatic. It happens by itself. So get the foundation right, then everything tends to come accordingly. And of course, the very first part here is the idea of going to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut. Yeah, it's the idea that seclusion is so important on the path of meditation. That's really what that means. And it shows us that the mindfulness of breathing is a very profound and deep meditation practice. It only really happens in seclusion. That's why people go on retreat. That's why you have forest monasteries. That's why you have all of these things, because the real insight, the real samadhi, tends to happen in seclusion and not in society, not around other people. So this is very important, yeah, and to be able to understand, I'm sure you understand already why that is the case. Obviously, first of all, because when you are around people, it tends to be very disturbing. You tend to kind of attach to that society, to being sociable or whatever it is. It always creates obstacles for the peace of the mind. But more importantly is the fact that in society, the world in general, you're always bombarded by all these sensual objects all the time. And it's very hard to withdraw the mind from sensuality if it is around you at all time. And that's why you have this kind of gradual movement away. You have the movement, first of all, the kaya viveka, you withdraw the body from the world. And then from the kaya viveka, you get the citta viveka. The mind also kind of is withdrawn from those sensual pleasures. So it has to be done in the right way. So you find a place of seclusion. Meditation always happens in seclusion, yeah, if it is the real thing. And this, of course, is what the Buddha is going to teach you, is the real thing, taking you all the way to the end of the path. So a root of a tree, yeah, it's it's kind of it's so, and then you have the empty hut, the sunyagara, and that's kind of what people use mostly these days. And then you sit down. Yeah, so mindfulness of breathing is a sitting down meditation practice. And again, I think quite important, because sometimes people say that you can do mindfulness of breathing while walking. Maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe you can. But obviously, because it is a profound meditation that is supposed to take you all the way to samadhi, it is preferable to sit down. It's less movement. It's more solid. You become more peaceful. It's much more difficult to get the same kind of peace while you're walking as when you're sitting down. So it is a sitting down meditation. And the next one then is having folded your legs crosswise. Yeah, set his body erect. And sometimes people say that the only way you can do anapanasati is by sitting down and crossing your legs. If you don't do that, if you don't sit down on your bottom and crossing your legs on the floor, then it's impossible to practice anapanasati. But I think that is taking the instructions a little bit too far. And one of the things that you see in the sutta, that in those days, the reason why people would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed was because that is how they were often used to sitting. And they were very comfortable like that. Yeah, and even now, if you sit cross-legged, if you are used to it and it's comfortable for you, and I see some of you do that a lot, then it feels quite nice. It feels quite solid. Yeah, you feel quite sturdy when you sit there. So it certainly is a good posture. But this should not be overstated. Yeah, much more important than whether you are cross-legged or not is that you actually are comfortable. That is far more important. If you're not comfortable, you are going to think about the past. You're going to think about the future. Yeah, you're going to fantasize about things because you just want to get away from the unpleasant present moment. It's so important to make the present moment pleasant, to be able to stay with it. So that is far more important. So this should not be taken too literally. What is important is that you have a kind of a stable and nice posture, so you can kind of make it last for a while, because mindfulness of breathing is an exercise which often takes time to develop. Yeah, so you should be stable. But apart from that, you can sit in almost any, use almost any posture. And if you have good mindfulness, you can even lie down. There are people who lie down and get good meditation that way. There are people who sit on chairs, get good meditation that way. There are people who sit on benches, get good meditation that way. So that is the most important thing, is that you're able to let go of the body. That's what really matters, that you are nice and stable. You set your body erect, yeah? So you have a kind of straight posture. And that too will depend a little bit on the circumstances. Sometimes if you are tired, or you've been working hard, your mind is not clear, sometimes you can kind of just relax a little bit in the beginning. Yeah, lean back against the wall. Don't have to sit straight away. But after a while, as your meditation develops, it becomes more natural for the body to be straight. Again, but you can also lie down, so it's not really absolutely required, even this one either. And then we get to the very last one of the instructions here. This is obviously the most important one, yeah? He says here, having established mindfulness in front of you. This is this phrase we were discussing the other day. Parimukkang satting upatapetra. Yeah? Parimukkang, someone asks, what does parimukkang mean? And there is actually where that phrase comes from. So having established mindfulness in front of you, what does that mean? First of all, you can see here that you actually do this prior to the moment you start watching the breath. This is a prior thing that we have to do. Yeah, having done it, then you watch your breath. You breathe in, you breathe out. So this is what I'm saying all the time about establish your mindfulness first. Take time at the beginning of your meditation. Don't go to the breath straight away. If you go to the breath straight away, you're going to have to use force because the mind doesn't want to be there. You're not really ready for it or whatever. So just take it slowly. Just enjoy being here. Allow yourself to settle down, the body to become really comfortable, your breath to slow down, and you kind of feel really nice about being here. Yeah? Don't go to the breath too fast. If you do that, it's not going to be comfortable. You're not going to be at ease with it. Having established mindfulness in front of you. And there's two ways of doing this, or maybe many more, but there's two main kind of ideas behind establishing mindfulness. And one of them is the long-term way, what we do in our daily life, how we live our ordinary life. And if you live your ordinary life well, if you do your everyday activities, if you do those well, with wisdom, with care, then you are gradually supporting the mindfulness in the long run. Yeah, this is exactly why you have to live your Buddhist life in an integrated way, and you have to bring everything has to be part of the spiritual path, because only then does it actually help you to establish mindfulness properly. This is why all of the virtue, the sila, is the first aspect of the path. When that has been established, then meditation becomes possible. So every day in your daily life, you're actually helping out in your meditation practice by living well, living in the right way. And every year when you come back here, ideally you will see a little bit of progress. And that is how you know that you have lived your life to its best potential in the rest of your rest of the year. Yeah, this is what I see in myself. I see every year a little bit better. Yeah, a little bit better. I'm not claiming anything. I think I started off very low, but you know, gradually getting a little bit better. And that is so beautiful when you see that change happening in you gradually over time. And then there is the establishing in the present moment. And that is all the other things I've been talking about. Yeah, sitting back. Relaxing, enjoying, having the right attitude, the idea of right view, of giving priority to your meditation. All of those things are what helps you to establish mindfulness in the here and now. Yeah, and very often it's just a matter of waiting, just a matter of being patient. This is one of the most important things. And if you are ready, if you have laid down the grounds, the basic things that are required, then it will actually happen by itself. All you have to wait, and the mindfulness tends to come. Sometimes it may take a day or two, but then things start to arise as a consequence. So this is how the mindfulness being established, how it happens. In front of you means parimukkang, as I was saying yesterday. It means in the present moment, of course, but also in the heat, in this space, right here, right now, yeah? In here and also in the present moment. And then you can be aware of the breath. And that is really where the mindfulness of breathing starts. So, there you are. That is the background for the mindfulness of breathing sutta. And tomorrow morning I will finish that off as a kind of the last part of this retreat. Okay, very good. So we'll see you again this evening at 7:30.